Hi, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Lisa Smith, and I'm the Chief Program Officer here at the Network of Jewish Human Service Agencies. And this topic came to Victoria and Laura and myself because they felt it was super important to talk about this subject. So thank you all for coming, and I'm thanking you in advance for sharing your experiences with us. And Laura and Victoria are going to sort of lead this discussion. So I want to pass it off to them. So there you go.
Great. Well, we're glad that everyone is here. And like Lisa so eloquently put in our invite, we wanted to just really hold space for this as social workers, social service professionals. We work with older adults, with Holocaust survivors. And it's a really unique time, I think, in American history where we're really talking about this. So we wanted to just share people's experiences, perhaps hearing disparaging comments, perhaps hearing anxious comments from clients. This is obviously a very triggering time for everyone. So we just wanted to make and hold space for this dialogue.
Yes, Laura. And I just want to say our last group was so incredibly lively, and there was so many topics of conversations related to COVID and the isolation. And then I feel like there was so much more we wanted to talk about. So we wanted to have this group to discuss the incredibly difficult challenge with working with our clients in a person-centered, trauma-informed way. And just to see what you guys have to say, we really wanted to leave it as an open forum for everybody and for everybody to share their experience, their insights, their best practices, and just, you know, like hearing what others are doing, because right now we're all in the same boat and we're all going kind of through the same situation, whether you're in the East Coast, Midwest, West Coast. So we would love to hear from all of you and what you guys have to say. So if anybody wants to share, go for it.
Hi, this is Carly from Philly. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this because we actually had a meeting last week with our agency's executive team and some of our board members on our ethics committee. And we presented a few examples and had a larger conversation just around how to take care of our social workers who are feeling, you know, their emotions are running so high right now, and it's such an intense time. We really wanted to be able to make sure that we were taking care of them when they were interacting with clients who tend to just be overtly racist in the things that they say. How do we pick up the phone every day when we know that what we're just going to be hearing a racist rant after a racist rant? Also, we talked a lot about when we try to push back, or, you know, I hate to use the phrase re-educate or educate, but when we try to refocus and say that that's not really a conversation that we'll engage in, we won't use that language, et cetera, it damages the rapport with our clients. So it really cultivates this sense with them of like, if you're not with me, you're against me. If you're not joining, then you're against me. And we know that the Holocaust survivor population, it's so difficult to do the relationship building and to build that trust right off the bat. So when we do that, but then we're at odds over something, it can damage the relationship. So we're kind of working in two different worlds where we want to say, we're not going to condone X, Y, and Z, but we also want to best support our clients and make sure we're meeting their needs. So that was really the core of our very lengthy discussion. And I have a couple of the social workers from my team on today too. So guys, let me know if I missed anything there.
I think that aligns really well with what I've been experiencing, you know, consistently with our clients, especially now as things come up with shifting in aides and schedules. Folks are really expressing a lot of things that can be challenging, that really make you think about you know, am I trying to re-educate, like you said, quote unquote, for my own purpose, or am I doing this in a trauma-informed way? So I think, if anything, I'm fairly grateful that it's almost like a, like putting theory to practice of what we learned so far about how to make space in a trauma-informed way when dealing with people that really push you to the brink of really wanting to try and bring them to your space instead of meeting them in theirs. So at least so far today, that's how it's been for me. So I'm very happy we're doing this conversation.
Julia, where are you calling in? Julia, where are you from?
I'm with Carly in the Philadelphia Holocaust Survivors Program.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Sorry, Pearl.
My name's Pearl, and I work in JFS, called JFS Clifton, but we're in Passaic now. We moved. I'm not sure. I haven't heard any of these kind of comments, but I mean, I assume you're talking about that the aides are Black. Is that the point that you're talking about? Because perhaps it's possible that many of our aides are Hispanic. I'm not sure exactly what all the aides are, but it's possible. There are a lot of, in this area that where we are, there are a lot of Hispanic people, and so maybe the Black issue doesn't come up as much. I'm not sure. You have something to say, Julia? You look like you were going to respond to that.
Yeah, I can respond now. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's fine.
Just to clarify this, so for our aides, they are Russian-speaking primarily. I mean, for our clients, the aides are Black and brown people who are non-Russian-speaking, but also brown people who are Russian-speaking from, you know, the former Soviet Union. So we have a lot of crossover in that sense with clients.
Very interesting. Well, I just wanted to, even though I don't know who this applies to or doesn't apply to, but I wonder, well, let's put it this way. I'll tell you my personal experience. My parents were the deceased. My parents were Holocaust survivors. And I know that some of their experience, let's say they had a business in an area, and they were, I believe it was in 1967, where there were riots, and they had like rotten tomatoes thrown at their store. They were just, you know, a mom and pop little store. And I'm wondering if some of the experiences of people, depending on what their experiences were, might impact their view on things, which doesn't mean, obviously, as we all know, that all Black people or Hispanic people or any kind of people are all the same. Obviously, that's ridiculous. But that doesn't mean it doesn't impact people's view on things. And I have to say, my mother she had an aide who was Black in her later years when she was, you know, really needed help. She was terrific. We really counted on her a lot. But I'm just saying, sometimes people's experiences, whatever they may be, makes them, you could say, prejudiced against various groups who they might have had a negative experience with. So I wonder if any of these people had some kind of experiences that make them look at it that way.
I would say potentially yes, but that's not, I don't know, the PCTI way, I don't even know what that is. I'm probably not the one who should be talking, but someone mentioned that, like, you can't re-educate because you wouldn't be doing something in a person, you know, PTCI way. I mean, I don't understand why you can't try to talk with people about the present, or is that completely too far afield? Carly, I think you could answer that.
So,
because it's a whole different world now, right? It's a new world that they have come to, that there's been a history of, you know, racism and...
Well, I just don't think that we ever want to... It's really hard to hear when someone says that a person of color is inherently more violent than everyone else or inherently not as intelligent as everyone else. So I think where we're struggling is, you know, our clients are in their 80s and 90s. I don't know how many minds we're changing or how much education we can necessarily do. I think we can absolutely say that this isn't the terminology or the language we're okay with using as social workers. But I think that, and especially, you know, I think there's an age component as well. We're like 40, 50, 60 years younger than some of our clients. I think that when we try to speak with them about certain things, it's like, you're not going to be teaching me anything today kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Julie, am I getting, and Julie is here too. Am I saying the right thing?
I was going to add, it's all of the above. It's very true. We walk a thin line, in my experience, no matter, you know, what my age may be, they still view me like as a child and as a grandchild. And so I walk a thin line between those people, quote unquote, which means very progressive folks that they view as like have lost their way, sometimes morally and ethically compared to what our clients believe is the right thing to do. And so if I suddenly become kind of grouped with that, you know, with those people in their mind, our rapport changes, and they don't, you know, they don't disclose information to me, and they don't really process their, you know, situations with me the way that they would if they felt that we were more aligned. And part of the thing that came up for us, for me, for example, I primarily service a Russian speaking caseload. And, you know, Pearl said that her parents were Holocaust survivors and they were in the United States for a long period of time and were exposed to this culture in some capacity. In the experience of many of my clients, they came here after 60. They are very entrenched in the former Soviet Union, you know, mindset and a cultural conversation around race that is very thoroughly grounded in a racist approach to everything and really has not done any of the work that has happened in popular culture in the United States. So even broaching that subject with them can sometimes be such an immediate severance of any connection.
So then I think, okay, I was just gonna say, then maybe we have to really talk with the case managers about exactly what you're saying to us right here, that they have.
I wanted to add to what Julia is saying. This is Deborah from JESSA in Washington. I think that people are a product of where they get their news. And even though some of our clients and some of our care managers have been in this country for, you know, since the early 1990s, a lot of them are still getting all of their news from Russian television. And, you know,
well, it's Russian television.
I don't have to tell you what the history of how Blacks are perceived in Russian culture, I'm sure that you all know. So, you know, it's just a big lift, I think. You're not going to get people to switch where they get their news from.
Has anyone had an experience where they've been able to, in a person-centered way, sort of redirect any of these comments in a conversation? I kind of, you know, before we were all talking racial justice, I also serve Russian-speaking Holocaust survivors who have enough English to communicate with me. And we also have a Russian-speaking care manager, but she's so busy, so I try to see people who are comfortable and happy to speak in English. And I've you know, when I've heard things like, well, I can't have a Black caregiver, you know, I've redirected and said, you know, Charna, we can't talk about anything except for the things that are going to be meaningful to your caregiving relationship. Like they'll say things like, I don't want a young person, which I get. It's actually anxiety causing for them, right? So you want someone who's maybe a little bit more of a contemporary. You want someone who's able to help you with schlepping groceries in, getting in and out of the car. Like, these are things that we can talk about, and these are things that we can't request because caregivers come in all different colors and with all different skill sets. We can talk about the skill sets that are meaningful to you. Like, I've tried to redirect, and it's been pretty, without sort of like shaming, but just saying like, these are the things that we can work on. I don't know if anyone else, and I'll just share one more anecdote that really like was in my heart when we were talking about having this conversation. It's a survivor who's since passed away. And he, years ago, I'm in Kansas City, and a young man named Michael Brown was murdered in Ferguson, Missouri. Mm-hmm. I went to speak to a survivor to sign him up for services. And he said to me, he didn't, you know, like many of our survivors, they're anxious and ambivalent about connecting with services because the process is so inhuman and like such a pain in the tush and you have to disclose so much. And he said, why do I need to, like, I don't want these benefits. I know the world hasn't changed. And you know how I know? A boy was just murdered in Ferguson, Missouri because of the color of his skin. And my family was just murdered because we're Jewish. And he said, the world hasn't changed. And it was like so powerful to me. And so, and we had to really process it as much as we could. And I said, Leo, that's horrible. Like, I can imagine that feels so sad and desperate. You know, there are people trying to change things anyway, but I don't know if anyone's had a positive experience being able to redirect, but those were just kind of like the two experiences that stuck out to me when I was thinking about this conversation.
Hi, this is Jen from the Jewish Care Program in Albuquerque, New Mexico. For me, I mean, I'm not trying to bring like a personal edge on it, but for me, I'm in particular more sensitive. I have, my daughter is half Black. And so when I experience these, it adds an extra layer of discomfort for me and a feeling of a need to speak out. But of course, as many of you have already, and Carly in particular, suggested that it really, you know, you walk that fine line on the trust issue and, you know, you don't want to tip that. But I had he's since passed as well, a survivor whom, not in this capacity, but I was actually in my previous position, not with the Jewish Care Program, was his court-appointed guardian. And so that kind of looked like, you know, I myself took him to all of his appointments and this and that. And, you know, he was clearly racist against people of color in general. But he also made some specific racial slurs to Black people. And he didn't know, and I didn't say anything because I don't always, you know, share that kind of information with the people. It just depends on the relationship. But he, you know, I was his guardian for 3 years, and then I was with him for 2 years in this position. And but when I was his guardian, you know, since I was around him a lot, my phone rang and had a picture of my daughter, which sparked a conversation for us to have on that. I don't think I changed his, I mean, I know I didn't, change his mind. I don't think that was the goal there, but at least we were able to get to a place where he wasn't vocalizing those things to me, which to me, you know, not by any means a victory over anything, but I thought that was good. But I don't have any answers, you know, in terms of like what to do. And I just, the struggle is really difficult for me, being that Elena is half Black. So I'm all ears to everybody's suggestions. And I think this is a really difficult conversation.
Jennifer, what it sounds to me, you know, like it's an incredibly difficult position to be in. You know, you have your family and you have your job, and we always want to do the best for our clients. But to me, it sounds like you drew, like, I don't know how it came about, but there was a boundary set where some of the stuff that was coming out of this guy was no longer coming out. So I'm wondering whether, you know, with staff, would they be able to maybe, you know, not re-educate, but put boundaries, you know, like you're talking about the subject. I'm really uncomfortable with that. I'm uncomfortable with the way you're describing people, or the way you're saying this about somebody. You know, I can't have this conversation. Like, would drawing boundaries be something that social workers could practice with clients?
I was, when Jennifer was speaking, and Victoria, this backtracks a little bit from your point and goes back to Jennifer's. I had a client whose grandchild was mixed, and, you know, this client, I thought we made headway and I thought we sort of progressed in the right direction with this person in terms of how they expressed their views about sort of racial matters, quote unquote. And then I think I lulled myself into a false sense of thinking that we were somewhere that I enjoyed. And then this person went back and, you know, started making comments that were just very racist against their own family members. You know, and very, and not sort of like, well, you know, they're not bad. They're just different. They're forever different. So the sort of things where I thought that we made kind of very concrete cognitive changes, and that wasn't the case. So I don't know. I'm also in that place where it's not a comfortable space for me. I don't know what the answers are. And there's hard boundaries that I set, for example, for disclosure about my personal life with clients. And I don't know how to bridge the gap without losing that rapport with them about racial matter conversations. Even if I said, this is not comfortable for me, that I know risks a long-term connection loss with these folks.
It's going to work.
I really appreciate you sharing that, Julia. Yeah, it's incredibly difficult conversation with no right or wrong answers right now. And we're all in it, and we're all just taking it one day at a time. And definitely, you know, building relationship with clients who suffered so much trauma and risking it all on something, it's incredibly difficult. And I was talking to one of our therapists yesterday, and they shared, they're incredibly progressive on everything. And then their client was also talking about racism in a very like Fox Network kind of way. And the therapist was like, you know, I really had the need to re-educate and tell them, like, you know, we're in 2020, like, let's see where things are. And then they were like, well, what is that in our relationship? Because I think right now the client is expressing their own anxiety in their own way, because they're also sitting in these very uncertain times, like we are sitting in certain times. We're verbalizing things one way, and sometimes I think they're verbalizing their anxieties in a way that might not resonate with our own. So that's just a thought.
I wonder if it could be helpful in certain cases, not in all, but to ask the survivor, when they say something negative about people from another race, what makes you say that? In other words, to help them to understand, where are they coming from? Because if you ask them, then you're not challenging them and breaking the trust or the relationship, but you just want to know, how did they come to think of things or look at things that way? And they might tell you. They might tell you a certain thing that happened one day, or that they saw on television, I don't know, or something, whatever they might tell you about, that gave them that impression. And then you would be having a conversation. It might open a conversation, but not in a confrontational way. So they might not break the relationship.
I think that's a great idea, Pearl.
Absolutely, that's such a beautiful statement, that when we're asking them questions, we're not challenging them, but we're just giving information. And then like the more you ask, you can kind of maybe, like, it goes in a different direction, you know, when you ask the right questions. I know that it's a technique that's actually used with kids, of like, well, I want this. And then you just keep asking questions to get to something else. And that's absolutely beautiful. I love that, Pearl, so much.
Thank you.
And I'm hearing a little bit also about kind of cultivating curiosity, right? Which I think is always a good, I don't know if any others had these conversations around the election, the 2016 election, or if it was probably just me. But some of my survivors were just so 100% sure that Donald J. Trump was the man with the plan. And I would just ask, who are you voting for? What are you? And I would say, well, tell me about that. Tell me what you're thinking. Like, I'm curious to hear. You always make the best decisions for you. Like, tell me about your thoughts. I think my thoughts might be a little different, but like, I'd be glad to talk more about it, you know, just to kind of cultivate some curiosity and, yeah, and I think stay curious ourselves too, which is hard, which I think is really hard when we feel passionately about things.
I had one client who was Polish. She just did not want somebody of color. And finally we just said, you know, that's who's available. You know, this is where we live, and these are the people who do this. So let's just try it and see how it works. And she went through one, and she went through, and she went through three, and she went through four. And number five stayed with her for 2 years, and they just loved each other. So, you know, it's sometimes it's a matter of just encouraging people to try. And it really, it was the truth I was telling her. I mean, that's, I have the same problem with men who only want men workers, and there aren't always around. So, you know, sometimes we just say, you know, this is what's available. And I say to people, you know, getting the right aid is like dating. You know, you don't marry the first person that you meet. Well, maybe some people do, but and you know, don't feel badly if it doesn't work out. You know, we can just can try somebody else. It's like dating. And so this sometimes it from a different view, you know, from a different angle happens too. But if you had a particularly bad experience and they've chosen to define it as racial, then, you know, that's a little more tough situation to handle.
You know, that brings up a really interesting point, Mavis, that we were also talking about in Philadelphia, is sometimes we find ourselves having to be almost a barrier between the client and the aide. You know, we've seen some egregious examples where, like, a home health aide wasn't allowed by the client to keep her lunch in the client's refrigerator, wasn't allowed to use the client's bathroom, where the client has put her hands physically on aides. So there is a part where eventually, you know, you hope that you'll find a good fit and that it'll stick. But in those other situations, we've found ourselves supporting the aides and almost doing like counseling for the aide because of what the client is doing and saying, even though we're there, of course, as the social worker and care manager for the client. So it's a really interesting dynamic because we feel compelled as human beings to say something to this woman that is being victimized. So it's all of these different perspectives of, you know, what is the role of trauma and how do we operate from a trauma-informed perspective with colleagues, the aides, the clients. Like, it sometimes it feels like it's conflicting when it should, we were hoping that it's cohesive, but sometimes it feels conflicting for us, I think.
Yeah, I'll jump in. I mean, we have the same issue. And I think a big issue for us is just validating that they have the right to feel how they are, but they also have to control it and treat their caregivers with respect. And we've had to send out letters to them that, you know, as an overall, like, you know, you can't talk this way to your caregivers, regardless of what race they are. But just, I mean, sometimes they're just downright rude to their caregivers anyway. And, you know, we've had to tell them that that's just, you know, you can feel how you feel, you can have whatever prejudices that you have, but, you know, if you want somebody to take care of you, you have to treat them with respect and be courteous to them when they're there and, you know, keep your feelings to yourself. And, you know, I know that sounds kind of harsh, but, you know, we can't go through caregiver after caregiver after caregiver. Eventually we just tell them that they're not going to get care anymore because they can't, you know, we don't have any of the other more options for them. So, and that seems to have worked for the most part. You know, we're not trying to change their minds. We're just trying to change their behavior.
It's hard though, when somebody is in early stage dementia and you don't know, you know, you know really how much control they have over what they're doing. And some days you feel like they know better than that. And some days do I have to advise the aide that, you know, this is something that they have to put up with. It's complicated because it's not, and when you're talking about trauma-informed, it's not just the Holocaust survivor that may have been through trauma. Often the aide has been as well. We have a lot of aides from Haiti that have been through some not very pleasant things in terms of how they got here and everything. So
Mavis, where is your agency?
We're in New York. We're in Rockland, New York, just north of the city.
Okay.
Yeah, it's that's one way that I try to bridge that connection between our clients and the aides, to try to not have them see the aides as other, because of like the perceived color of skin and perceived lived experience, but to see themselves reflected back in that kind of way. And my conversations with clients so far have kind of come to, again, to like a weird stop where they recognize that these people also had complex lives, but then go back to like a pre-programmed, you know, racial ethnic bias that they're very comfortable with and really don't recognize as needing any challenge. And that's the point at which I would sort of back off and say that's, you know, at this point, if I'm pushing past it, then I'm doing it more for my own comfort and less, you know, for an effective working relationship.
As Carly was saying, most often with live-in caregivers, we find that we are kind of relationship counselors between the client and the caregiver, because it's reminding them that they really do care about one another, that the caregiver is doing an excellent job, and having the client acknowledge that. And that's been successful in some client aid relationships. However, we have had to switch out aids because we felt it was not a healthy relationship any longer, and that it was that the client perhaps was at risk because the caregiver couldn't tolerate, while they understood that this person has some dementia and that not fully in control of what they say or what they do, that everybody reaches a point where it's not healthy. And I think with live-in caregivers, that we really do monitor that, you know, very closely, because that's a different kind of relationship. That is 24/7.
Absolutely. And I think like one of the, I just want to add to that, you know, like we're all in social work, and kind of our values as social workers and the NASW code of ethics, you know, we have to respect client self-determination, but at the same time, we're fighting for social justice. And these two things are sitting with us, and they're not sitting well with us. If they're sitting with our social workers, with our supervisors, with everybody. And I think like some of the like anxiety and some of the frustrations coming out in the social workers is related to the fact that we're all fighting a good fight, and we all want to help everybody out, but at the same time, respecting clients' wishes and thoughts is also part of that. And you know, that's where a lot of conflict arises. And just acknowledging that fact with the social workers is incredibly important.
I wonder about experiences people have had professionally feeling unsupported in their, you know, views on it with colleagues or with administration, and really feeling like they can't advocate for it in workspaces. I'm very grateful for where I am now, but I know that I've been in social service environments where that was the case, and I felt like there would be no support for myself professionally or personally if I advocated for these things.
Are you asking a question? Was that a question that you were asking us?
Sort of, yes, in speech form.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Julie, can you say that one more time? I'm sorry.
What I was saying is that I wonder how or if people have experienced a professional setting where whether colleagues or folks, you know, in administrative positions above and around them made them feel like they were unsupported in advocating for racial justice and social, you know, empowerment. So, because I know I've experienced it in other professional settings, and that was demoralizing.
Has anyone on this call experienced that?
Hello,
please, Missy.
I don't have the yes to that. That of your question, I would have to say the opposite. And I don't know what other agencies have been doing, you know, more recently and stuff like that. But I know that for us, we had all the chiefs and the admins and the directors and supervisors all had a meeting and said, okay, let's, you know, and like, I thought that was, you know, pretty incredible for us to do. Hopefully I'm not that surprised that we actually did that, but like more like, where do we sit as an agency? Do you feel that we're racist in some of our what we do in our programs and whatever. And we had a really good discussion at first I actually said to my supervisor, I'm like, I just want you to know, I'm going to be really quiet. I'm not saying anything in the meeting. If they go on around, I'm going to not answer those questions they set out. I'm not sure I want to. I don't know if I should feel comfortable. I don't know how someone else is going to react if I'm going to say something. I don't want it, you know, like whatever. And we all talked. It was so great. We had some of our Black staff actually talk about their experience in the community at work. It was really powerful, and I think it helped our staff to now kind of be able to talk about this and be able to say, hey, why does our brochure look like this and not like this or something like that? And we're feeling more open to be able to do that. So I would encourage for that, for us, that was helpful for our agency as a whole, because it's really important as a Jewish agency, you know, to, I guess, do an agency.
So Missy, I'm assuming then that you spoke in that meeting.
You're going to ask me what I said and I don't remember.
No, I'm not going to ask you what you said, but you said you were going to be quiet, but you spoke in the meeting. Yeah.
It just, it, you know, I think I wasn't sure what it was going to be like. I really wasn't sure. And it was, we really could say what we really felt about the agency. You know, we're not calling this staff member racist or who's doing the promotion of whatever, but saying, why aren't we doing this?
Right.
And maybe we're not putting out the message that we're all saying that we do, you know, and what we stand by. You know, here's our slogan or our, you know, we say we do this, but are we really doing that? It fostered really good conversation in a really positive way. And it could have went south. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I think people in general have a lot of thoughts on this. And our agency has been doing agency-wide meetings right now to discuss, because like in Los Angeles, one of the areas that got polluted the most was primarily Jewish neighborhoods. So our clients had a lot of, triggering thoughts, which resulted in a lot of racist rhetoric. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting because I feel like our workforce is so diverse, and then our staff was able to share kind of some of the thoughts, some of the issues. And I think it's good, like, you need to air it out, and it's an incredibly uncomfortable conversation to have. And because people will have different thoughts and different perceptions, different ideas, different politics, but it's such an important conversation to have. And it's like the more difficult the conversation, the better the outcome. But it's important to have those conversations with staff, with supervisors, with the higher management. And I really encourage, I hope like all the agencies are doing that, where they're able to bring that to the table and discuss events, you know, with how clients are taking it, how the staff is taking it. And just the responses some people were able to share were so powerful.
I just shared an article that I just wanted to make sure everyone had seen. I don't know if you had seen it, but an article that was published last week that's been very powerful and making the rounds in our agency. And I agree. I think like you, Missy, we've had a really active, I'm really proud to say, a very active cultural, we called it our cultural competency team. And we've been working on an anti-discrimination policy for the agency and making sure that LGBTQ+ services are really transparent on our website and really visible. So this has just been, I think, a really important time to clarify our values and say them out loud. And so that's, I guess, the upside of all of this, right? There, maybe there's a little upside to this, so.
I can say also something that we're really excited about in Philly is our CEO is currently interviewing a diversity/anti-racism organization or consultant to come in and do a mandatory training. We're not calling it mandatory, we're calling it required training for all of our staff, because it was really a push from our associates, from staff at all levels, was like, we don't want to lose the momentum. We're having these conversations. We're talking in our teams. We're talking as a full 140 plus person staff. Let's not just send out like suggested Amazon books to read. Let's actually keep this going. And what does that look like? So we are going to be doing this like ongoing, you know, anti-racism training, diversity training, which I think is wonderful. And I think our board is on board. So hopefully it really trickles down from the executive team and the board in all ways. But I think that it's really comforting to staff to know that we have an ongoing commitment to this. And it's not just like everyone's feeling really emotional and there's a lot going on. So we'll just band-aid it for now and then kind of forget about it and let it fizzle out. We're going to continue this work. And we have a trauma committee at JFCS Philly too. We call it SIT, Sensitivity and Trauma. And what we're kind of taking under our wing is keeping us accountable to these diversity trainings and these anti-racism trainings, and always kind of sending out surveys and asking people what they need, because we found that, you know, some people are more comfortable speaking in groups and others feel less comfortable or less safe completely voicing their full opinion in front of their supervisors and bosses. So we're hoping to be a repository for resources and also to be kind of the voice of the agency. So that has been working, I think, really well. Julia's on it too.
Very excited about it, yes. Like I said, this environment has been very, in some ways, very healing, to, you know, to be part of, especially with everything going on now.
Well, it sounds like good things are happening in different agencies with staff, but I guess the purpose of this call was really for us to understand how we are, you know, working with our survivors. How about other people that we haven't heard from? What are you experiencing? How are you managing it? Any good ideas? We've gotten a few so far.
I spoke before, but since it's quiet for a second, I can share some of the stuff. I mean, so I think we're really doing what most of you guys are doing, or most of you folks are doing with, you know, the caregivers and, you know, we're really clear about, you know, we want this to be a good relationship. So, you know, if I want to hear if things aren't going well, let's hear why, let's see if we need to change caregivers, you know, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. But we're also able in some instances to do, we call it reimbursement, but so we're able to have the client themselves. So I think this kind of brings up that like voice and choice and all that, you know, we love the PCGI stuff. So, so that they can pick their own caregiver, you know, and so sometimes that helps them foster a better relationship because it's on them. They chose it. They may have interviewed the person. Sometimes it's offering to, you know, be there the first visit because it's scary, a new person, you know, that's coming in their home. So, you know, we'll say, how about, would you like if I was there on your first visit and we can do an introduction, you know, just finding out maybe what that insecurity is. And so that we're able to maybe kind of, you know, lessen that a little bit, but the them picking their own caregiver agency or whatever does help sometimes if you're able to do it.
The big if, Mavis isn't. So, what about Anat? You usually have something to tell us. Are you still with us?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm here. I'm here. Let's log on to my phone because my computer's not working. First of all, this is wonderful. Thank you for doing this.
You're so welcome.
Thank you. This is wonderful. I've learned a lot, definitely, and our agency also is engaging in many conversations and policies. We actually had a meeting, an all-staff meeting today and tomorrow as well. I think many of the conversations that I'm having with clients, and I can't remember who said it earlier, is asking them, where is this coming from when they make comments? Because we don't know where it's coming from. So I'm asking them. We are also here in Atlanta, probably 99% of the caregivers are African-American and Black. And when a new client mentions that they need home care, they say, well, but I don't want, you know, somebody that is brown or Black to come into my house. Then we educate them. Just like we educate them, if it's a first-time home care client, what does home care mean? What is a caregiver? A caregiver will use your bathroom. A caregiver is entering your home for 12 hours. A caregiver will need to eat after 12 hours. So where do they put the food? So a lot of education about what it is, and especially for new clients. And we listen to them. We really do. We just listen to them a lot.
Right. Isn't that what the first rule of social work is? Active listening.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to think about that. You're so right.
Active listening. And I keep reminding myself and the rest of the team, we talk a lot, that this is not about us. They are the clients. Yeah. And we are holding space for them now.
Yeah, good point. Thanks for telling us that. We need to hear it again. So we have like another 10 minutes or so. Is there anyone else who wants to share anything that they're doing?
Well, I'm Jessica. I'm also from Philadelphia. I think we have a real crowd here. But one thing that's been helpful for me also is engaging people from the agencies that we're hiring the aides from, to share with them, and they pass on to the aides that we are supportive of the aides and that we want very much for them to be taken care of. And having that message coordinated from another direction is actually pretty helpful sometimes. Mm-hmm.
It's why it's really important for us to also train those caregivers in those PCTI, you know, trainings for the caregivers and stuff. And we do a ton of those, and we don't make it mandatory, but we talk about it. Maybe it should be mandatory for those agencies who want to work with our clients to learn also about that trauma. And I know in the trainings that I do, like it was mentioned earlier, we absolutely are addressing, you may have experienced some type of trauma too, and what that relationship might look like. And what would that be like for you? And so, I mean, it's just that point. So,
yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I've spoken plenty, please.
Please share. Please share.
I was going to just give an example in terms of agencies. I actually today had a really good call with an agency. With a client who's just having some difficulty with keeping consistency with staff because the aides choose not to come back. So the conversation was very good, but I was thinking about a different client who did have trauma as a Russian-speaking Jewish person where they kept being offered Russian-speaking aides that they had anti-Semitic encounters, you know, reported with. And so the children of the client said, please let us get set up with an English-speaking provider with non-Russian speaking aides, and then, you know, we'll hope for the best. And it did work out in a better way. Mm-hmm. So that was one of those sort of backward things that kind of gives you some thought on that.
Right. Jonathan, did you want to say anything to us? You've been nodding a lot at what everyone's saying. I didn't know.
Hi. No, I'm nodding because I had a similar experience where a client actually, you know, they because we do work with an agency that has Russian speaking aides, and they didn't want them. They preferred to work with someone else and not someone. You know, I assumed that they would want somebody that speaks Russian because they speak Russian, and they said no. We prefer to work with someone who speaks English, you know, because of traumas and stuff like that from the past. So I think that's, that resonated with me.
Gotcha.
Laura, I interrupted your, what were you going to say?
I'm like thinking to myself, how silly to say this, but this is another, I just wanted to share a really positive, sweet experience I had with a survivor whose wife was a little bit younger than him and actually American born, and they had a lot of care. He was really full care at the end of his life. So they had caregivers in the house all the time. And one of the caregivers who they really adored was a Black Muslim woman from Africa. And she brought her rug and would pray while she was there caregiving for Tibor, you know, over extended periods of time. And the family loved it. And it was just like those moments kind of sustain you in the really tough moments. And it was just very affirming for me and for the family. And so I hope we can have some of those moments too, because there are a lot of tough moments. It's mostly tough moments right now. So I hope that we can all have, and if not, you can just come to Kansas City, hop in the car, don't have to get on a plane. There's lots of good stuff happening here. But it was really affirming for me, and it was really an experience. I think, you know, having a caregiver in the home is so hard as it is. Mm-hmm. So when the experiences can be affirming, I think it just kind of carries us through the difficult times.
That was a nice way to end this difficult discussion. And this honest, you know, people were honest and open, and that's what, you know, we wanted. I mean, Victoria and Laura are always thinking about, you know, what the needs of this group could be. And I'm glad that we could do this pop-up and that people were able to come. And if any of you have any ideas or thoughts about what kinds of discussions you want to have, all you have to do is reach out to us and we can make it happen. And I think Carly did reach out to us. Was it you who originally wrote us, Carly? Then that's how this happened. So you all have power, and we want you to use it, because we want this affinity group to be, to meet your needs and to be important to you, for you. So that's my plug.
I just want to second that, Lisa. That was really great. We are here for everybody, and we want to, you know, we want to be where you guys are, and we want to talk about topics that are relevant to you. So if you have any ideas, anything you want to talk about, whether it's happy times or sad times or challenging times, we want to broach those topics. We want to discuss those topics, because we're all in it together. And I think in today's world, it's a literal thing. It's not figurative anymore. So please reach out to us. We'll be happy to hear from you and continue having wonderful conversations with everybody here.
Okay, and I have one last thing to say, and then everyone can go. Laura, this was the very first affinity group, and now there are 26 affinity groups that I run. But Laura is the one who tagged the phrase that is used for every single affinity group: together we are better. And it's true. So together we are better. I hope everybody stays safe. Laura, thank you for the tagline for the network. And I guess we'll see you in July whenever our affinity group is next. I don't know, but you have it down. People must have it somewhere.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for running this group.
Okay, we're glad we could. I'm trying to tell you when it
August,
is.
August, right, Lisa?
I'm looking. I should have had that.
It's August 13th, Thursday, August 13th.
Terrific. See you all then. Until then, if you want to have a pop-up, let us know what you're interested in. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Okay. Bye, you guys.
Thank you.